the intelligence agencies working with the structural power elite was a part of all four of those murders.
I think the key figures right now are Sharon and Arafat.
And I do agree with Secretary of State Colin Powell when he said if this roadmap comes to an end, both sides are going to fall from the high cliff.
300 Taliban plus drove across the border into Afghanistan in a convoy of trucks, took over a administrative headquarters in town of Barmal and held it for 5 hours.
Instead of being on the side of corporate power in these nations, on the side of the despots, let us get on the side of the people themselves.
All of the key economic decisions that are going to affect the ability of that new government, those decisions will all have already have been made and contracts will be locked in.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, August 21st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The United Nations system worldwide paid homage yesterday to top UN envoy Sergio Vieira de Mello and other staffers killed in Tuesday's terrorist bombing in Baghdad after a truck bomb exploded at UN headquarters, killing at least 23 people and wounding close to 100. Individuals expressed sorrow at the grievous loss while voicing outrage at the savage attack and vowing to redouble the world body's humanitarian and peacekeeping work. Tributes were held from Geneva to Gaza to Bangkok to Nairobi to Timor, a veritable world atlas of places de Mello had touched with his humanitarian and peacekeeping work during more than 30 years of service. UN agency chiefs echoed Secretary General Kofi Annan's expressions yesterday of his own personal grief and the loss the entire international community had suffered with the death of his special representative for Iraq and High Commissioner for Human Rights. Annan described it as an outrageous act of violence aimed directly at those who are trying to help the people of Iraq to rebuild their damaged country. World Health Organization Director General Lee Jong-wook said, throughout a long and impressive UN career, Sergio has served the people who needed him most with skill, compassion, and good humor. The single act of terrorism deprives the Iraqi people and people everywhere of a great advocate and a fine man. He will be sorely missed. Speaking at UN headquarters in New York earlier today, Secretary General Annan and U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell discussed strengthening security in Iraq.
I have lost some very close friends and close colleagues, and I'm sure you all received the news with the same shock and awe that and confusion that I did. But we must carry on. We must have strength. For their sake, yes, let's take time to mourn, but we must also return to our mission with keen determination to succeed, and that is the only way to honor them. Otherwise, their lives would have been lost in vain.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, the U.S. is considering a new resolution calling on other nations to contribute troops and humanitarian aid to the region. Earlier today, Israeli helicopters in Gaza dropped 5 missiles on a car carrying Ismail Abu Shanab, a senior Hamas official. Abu Shanab and 2 of his bodyguards were killed. The attack took place in a heavily populated neighborhood, wounding 14 passersby. For an update and analysis of the situation, Peace Watch checked in with Elias Zananiri, a spokesperson for the Palestinian Authority and Internal Security Minister Mohammed Dahalan.
Following the assassination, the whole atmosphere was dramatically changed in Gaza Strip. Before the assassination, the Palestinian Authority was basically on the verge of starting a large-scale campaign, a protracted campaign against the activists of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad following the suicide bombing attack in West Jerusalem. And the security forces of the PA went into even details of even lists of names and targets of institutions that were to be targeted by the Palestinian security forces. And more importantly than that, the people had expressed their understanding of those measures that the PA was to take against these two groups. But when the assassination came forward, that really disrupted everything and undermined not only the plans, but even the mere existence of the Abu Mazen government. Now we are back to square number one and hearing from both sides. Israel on one hand is saying that there is no Hudna. The Hamas and the Islamic Jihad on their side say there is no Hudna. Ironically enough, the only party that is talking, still talking about the Hudna is the Palestinian National Authority, and Hudna is the ceasefire. So the PA is the only party that is talking about a ceasefire, while Israel is saying from its end that there is no ceasefire anymore. And the fundamentalist groups on their end, say too that there is no ceasefire. The whole situation is really complex, very, very sad, very fragile, and I'm afraid that we are heading back to the same cycle of reaction and reaction, this kind of cycle that characterized the last 3 years.
In fact, Reuters is reporting that thousands of Palestinians gathered at the scene of the bombing, shouting death to Israel, death to Abbas, and denouncing his adherence to the U.S.-backed peace plan. How does the Palestinian Authority respond to this?
As I said, after the assassination, the whole mood of the street and the people in the streets has changed. People are very strongly anti-Israel and even against the PA if it decides to take any drastic actions now against the two groups, because we cannot be seen by our own people as doing what the Israelis are also doing by air force. This is very crucial, and this is an element that needs to be understood. Whoever took the decision today to assassinate Abu Shanab in Gaza knew in advance that this action is going to undermine the Palestinian Authority. We even sometimes get the feeling or the impression that somebody within the Israeli government does not have any interest in seeing a successful PA that is doing the job the way it has to be done.
How representative would you say this sort of sentiment is of the mood of the average Palestinians? Are people you've spoken to personally generally in support of the so-called roadmap to peace, or do they have concerns that they feel have not yet been addressed?
With regard to the roadmap itself, I mean, it is clear that even the roadmap as it is also facing the stake of collapse. If the ceasefire falls and if the Israelis renew their assassination or targeted killings of Palestinians and the fundamentalist groups react with the suicide bombings, there won't be any chance to speak of the roadmap anymore. And I do agree with the Secretary of State Colin Powell when he said that if this roadmap comes to an end, that means both sides are going to fall from a high cliff. And this is really true. I mean, what is now, the question is, what can the United States do in order to prevent any side of the two sides from falling from that cliff?
Hmm. There was supposed to be a ceasefire in existence, yet earlier this week we witnessed the Hamas bombing of a Jerusalem bus, which killed 20 Israeli passengers. That, of course, was in retaliation for an earlier Israeli assassination of a Hamas leader. So would you consider that ceasefire to just basically at this point be null and void, or does it have any validity at this point?
The whole concept of the ceasefire now depends on what exactly the Israeli government is going to do. The Israeli army is now almost in every single Palestinian city in the West Bank. They have moved tanks into these cities, and they have moved troops into those cities. And they are talking openly about staying in those cities for quite a long period of time. So where is the ceasefire? There isn't any ceasefire. In fact, the only party that is really committed to the ceasefire is the Palestinian Authority. And this is really very sad. I mean, that is why I'm saying that the United States has to take measures now, intervene as soon as they can, and before it becomes really too late, in order to prevent the deterioration back to the hellish situation that both sides have lived in over the last 3 years. My feeling now is that we are in the last minute before the collapse, and if no miracles happen, then both sides are going to collapse, and I'm not a good or strong believer in miracles anyway.
Well, when you say that only the Palestinian Authority has recognized or observed the ceasefire, does the Palestinian Authority have any influence or control over the actions of groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad? And
well,
does it have?
We have managed to control the influence of those groups and their activities by means of reaching a dialogue and an agreement. Settlement with them to go for a truce, for a ceasefire, because that meant for us giving the Palestinian Authority the chance to rehabilitate its own troops, its own security forces that had been devastated, in fact, destroyed, fully destroyed by the Israeli army in 3 years of conflict. I mean, I know that there are many in Israel who say that this ceasefire was not really serious, but I would like to remind the Israelis and also the American public as well that in those 6 weeks of truce, the number of security warnings that the Israelis used to have, the intelligence in Israel used to have about potential suicide bombers was about 50 or 60 warnings per day. But during those 2 months of ceasefire, the warnings dropped down to about 7 a day. There hasn't been a single suicide bombing inside Israel for the last 6 weeks, with the exception of what happened last week, of course, in Rosh Hashanah and later on in Jerusalem.
So,
and that only started after the Israeli army went into Nablus, killing 2 members of Hamas, and then had triggered the suicide bombing inside Israel in Rosh Hashanah a day later. And then the Israelis again went into Hebron and killed one of the leading members of the Islamic Jihad, prompting again another suicide bomber, the second one that attacked West Jerusalem on Tuesday evening. Having said that, we in the Palestinian Authority made clear that Israeli violations of the ceasefire do not justify the kind of suicide bombings or the kind of attacks that the Palestinian fundamentalist groups carried out, because we said that these attacks are very detrimental to the national security of the Palestinian people, and that they, and regardless of what the Israelis do, we have to do our job in maintaining the security and the ceasefire. Unfortunately, the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad did not listen. They went ahead and they carried out the second suicide bombing, that was the one on Tuesday evening in Jerusalem. That prompted the PA to take drastic decisions and measures against these two groups. We were on the verge of starting all these measures when the assassination took place in Gaza. The assassination undermined all of our plans, and it even undermined the mere existence of the government of Abu Mazen and of the Palestinian National Authority.
Elias Zananiri is a spokesperson for Palestinian Authority Internal Security Minister Mohammed Dahalan. We also spoke this afternoon with Ghassan Andoni, Senior Coordinator with the International Solidarity Movement. We began by asking how peace activists in the region feel about the recent events and if they shared Zananiri's pessimism that the so-called roadmap to peace is on the verge of collapse.
Unfortunately, how the situation developed lately do point to a high level of pessimism in terms of the chances to sustain the truce, which is what allowed the roadmap plan to develop.
Reuters news agency is reporting that following this morning's bombing in Gaza, thousands of Palestinians gathered at the scene shouting death to Israel, death to Abbas, and denouncing their leaders' adherence to the U.S.-backed peace plan. Now Abbas was put in power several months back to replace Yasser Arafat, whose leadership abilities, according to many critics, was ineffectual and largely symbolic. But it seems as if we're now witnessing that he also is losing any credibility he might have once had.
I don't think that is a question of credibility, but rather than the question of willingness from both parties to continue the effort. Abbas is genuine in his effort trying to solve this issue with diplomatic means only. And I doubt that the Israeli government have the same intentions, and as well, organizations like Hamas and Islamic Jihad have repeatedly announced that they have no faith in this process and they consider this process as a way to call off Palestinian rights and dictate on Palestinians an unacceptable solution. So in a way, there are, in my point of view, parties who were working contrary to Abbas wanted to achieve. There was a remarkable success from the side of Abbas with the issue arriving at a truce through an understanding Palestinian militant radical groups. And I truly believe as activists that everybody who's interested in a peaceful solution should give the option a chance. The problem is Israel and the Israeli army did not. Even when the two organizations, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and according to the testimonies of Israeli army officials, were strictly abiding to the truth, Israeli army continued targeting their activists, killing scores and arresting scores more. And that mounted a lot of pressure on both organizations. And I think it was a mistake in my point of view, but this pressure has delivered what many Israeli right-wing generals wanted to see, which is a reaction that will allow Israel to change the rules of the game and destroy completely the idea of that the roadmap can be based on a negotiated truce with understanding agreements reached by all parties involved, including Palestinian resistance groups. Abbas is stuck in an awkward position right now. At one point, the demand was always to dismantle and disarm Palestinian resistance groups, and that wasn't what Abbas wanted to do. What Abbas wanted to do is to reach an understanding and at the end of the road, arrive at a situation where there will be only one authority and one legal arm in Palestine. To me, choice was the right one. Unfortunately, opponents from both sides of the spectrum were stronger in their repulsive attitudes that his efforts collapsed.
Well, are Palestinian and Israeli peace activists that you've spoken to generally in support of the so-called roadmap to peace, or do they have concerns about it as well?
Yeah, I mean, look, in the roadmap was the only way in which a chance could be provided for the region to step out of the vicious cycle of violence, attacks, and counterattacks. None of us think that the roadmap is a fair deal, nor it's a just deal, nor it has the elements of success. The question is whether people are interested in breaking this cycle of violence. If yes, then this is the only vehicle available. Otherwise, the continuity of the same cycle is guaranteed. I personally think that giving a chance to this plan, at least to get us out of this cycle of violence, is important. But truly, I don't have faith that this plan as it stands is capable of bringing about an acceptable level of a just peace in the region.
Ghassan Andoni is a senior coordinator with the International Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Unfortunately, critics say today's assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Abu Shanab is merely one instance of a growing foreign policy tactic employed not only by Israel, but by the United States in its ever-expanding war on terror. Most recently, the U.S. military killed Uday and Qusay, Saddam Hussein's two sons, late last month. Anna Shalal, the founder of Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, shared these thoughts as he was interviewed on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Can you begin with your reaction to the news of the death of Uday and Qusay Hussein?
The first thing that I thought of is these pictures really aren't for the Iraqi consumption, but rather I think they're for the rest of the world, and particularly the U.S. consumption for George Bush and his government and his military to show a trophy to say that the war is going in the right way and to make it seem as if it is really done for and on behalf of the Iraqi people. So I don't think the Iraqi people really cared whether or not the pictures were being shown. I think some of them were offended by showing them. Others were already convinced that Uday and Qusay weren't about to return to power, and showing them dead or alive just really didn't matter.
Why do you think it is that the United States forces actually did kill them in this shootout? Wouldn't it have made much more sense in terms of the international community if these two men were brought before a war crimes tribunal or some sort of international body to be prosecuted?
Absolutely. I think this family, including Saddam Hussein and his sons, had controlled the Iraqi mindset for so many years, over 35 years. And for the most part, they've sort of written Iraq's history in their own words. And the Iraqis have not had a chance to be able to deconstruct and poke holes in that history that has been written for them. And now the U.S. military is sort of taking the role of rewriting Iraq's history. The fact is the Iraqi people should be the only ones that should be able to write Iraq's history. They should be the only arbiters in how to deal with Uday and Qusay. And let's remember that Uday and Qusay really did nothing as far as crime to hurt the United States. their crime is against the people of Iraq, and the people of Iraq should be the ones that make the decision on how justice should be meted to them. They should have been put on trial, because right now their fate became no different than any of the fate of the thousands of people that were killed in the collateral damage that the U.S. military conducted during this last war.
At the beginning of the U.S. invasion in late March, there were some images of dead American soldiers broadcast around the world, and there was much outrage from government officials in this country. Maybe you can give us your thoughts on the publication of these photos by the U.S., of these photos of the Hussein sons.
It certainly is not becoming of a civil democracy, as we claim to be here in the United States. The idea of sort of holding up these trophies in front of the world of dead bodies, like having heads on a stick, seem to have a real sort of a savage tint to them. I don't think it plays well outside of the United States. I think, like I said, I think George Bush needed to have a boost in his popularity. His economic agenda, his domestic agenda is faltering badly. The war in Iraq isn't doing so well. The war in Afghanistan isn't doing so well. There's many issues that are left unresolved. And I think a high-profile sort of capture or killing of these two was what the doctor ordered, and it was just a temporary fix. And I think we'll see that the tide is already beginning to turn around, and the criticism has taken hold of the way we're conducting ourselves in this war. And the Iraqi people in particular are getting more and more upset. Much of the holding back of the electricity, the Iraqi people believe that it's being done to punish the Iraqi people. There's signs on U.S. tanks and Humvees and U.S. vehicles that say, give us security and we'll give you electricity.
Mm.
And those types of basic human needs are being used as a form of bribery. So they're withholding them at will, and the Iraqi people aren't very happy with that, because they feel the sense of this collective punishment has got to end just because there's a few people that happen to be against this occupation, and showing it by the violence that they're conducting against U.S. troops does not allow the U.S. should not allow the U.S. military to punish a whole population.
Anas Shalal is the founder of Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives. He was interviewed on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Openly and outrightly assassinating our opponents may seem like a new low in American foreign policy, but in fact, some historians say it's a policy that's been taking place for years, both on a foreign and domestic level. A new book edited by investigative reporters James DiEugenio and Lisa Peace, entitled Assassinations, examines the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X. It's based on over 2 million pages of recently declassified documents on those deaths and the events surrounding them. DiEugenio spoke recently with Mark Babawi of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston.
We basically came to the conclusion that, A, the official story in all those cases is flat out wrong, okay, that, B, there was a huge cover-up in every single one of those assassinations, and that, C, from the available evidence that we have, the powers that be, the whatever you want to call them, the intelligence agencies working with the structural power elite, okay, was a part of all four of those murders. And so, in the afterword, I basically said that if such is the case, then they certainly succeeded in what appeared to be their agenda, which was to wipe out the last liberal bastion, as Cynthia McKinney was calling it, of progressive leftism in this country. And this resulted in the presidency of Richard Nixon in 1968, which, of course, historically speaking, was a milestone, because that was the event that led to the, whatever you want to call it, the rise of the new right later on in the 1970s or whatever. And that, of course, became a hurricane, which dominates the country today. And it's really amazing to think about it, because people like me who are old enough to remember what it was like before that, it really was a different country. And it's gone about 180 degrees. And we decided to focus on those four murders as the entry point for the takeover. And I think in retrospect, that's a correct analysis.
Yeah, I think they really did precipitate a big change in the country. Let's explore that point a little further, if we could. You said that the right wing, which is so powerful and influential at the moment, has its roots in that time. Who are some of the people who are around then whose, I guess, ideological descendants are now in power? Can you name some of the names for us?
That's a great question. It's a really great question. Because, of course, Richard Nixon became president as a direct result of the assassination of Robert Kennedy.
Right.
Well, if you take a look at Joe McGinnis's book, The Making of the President, you'll see for the first time mentioned, I think, in any nonfiction book up to that time, a gentleman by the name of Roger Ailes. Roger Ailes was a low-level assistant on that particular campaign. Now, of course, everyone knows who Roger Ailes is today, because this is a guy who basically revolutionized the entire media system in America today. He was a guy who put together the 600 radio network of Rush Limbaugh, rehearsed him, put him on ABC, etc., radio, and made him, well, to go into all the influence that guy, Rush Limbaugh's had on talk radio, would take another show. But let's just say it was revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Then, when he did such a great job with Rush Limbaugh, of course, Rupert Murdoch noticed this, and he hired him to be the Fox News director. Okay, so that's what Roger Ailes does today. He's the editor for Fox. Another guy who worked in that campaign, of course, was Lee Atwater. Okay, and Lee Atwater, before he passed away, was the manager of the Bush campaign in 1988 that crushed Michael Dukakis. And, you know, the Atwater and Ailes worked together on that campaign, as they did in 1968, and he put together the Willie Horton ad, which, well, he says he didn't, but if you read between the lines, he approved it. Okay, and that, of course, played upon the race politics that have become so popular in these days. So if you take a look at what was going on back then, you know, a lot of these guys who would have never come to power, okay, those assassinations, especially the last one, went ahead, and that was the Pandora's box that led them to the keys of the kingdom.
Well, quite often, you know, people say this was so long ago, you know, move on, and times have changed, and those people aren't around, but the reason I ask you that question is those people are very much around,
and
the people who they kind of mentored are also still around, and mm-hmm. It's very important for people to understand the history, just so that we
Roger
can understand
Ailes
where
Roger Ailes is
we're
probably
going.
The single most important person in the media there is today, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it does matter, okay, if we take a look at where he came from and how he came into power. If Robert Kennedy would have never been assassinated, I very doubt that anybody would have ever heard of Roger Ailes.
Investigative reporter James D. Eugenio is the co-author of the recent book Assassinations. He spoke with Mark Babawi of Pacifica Station, KPFT in Houston.
Hi, this is Jim Hightower. If you find what they do valuable, please make a financial commitment to Peace Watch so they can continue their work on your behalf. Kindly make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at pacifica.org. That's pacifica.org. Or you can send a tax-exempt donation via check or money order addressed to Peace Watch, care of Pacifica, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Thanks a lot for your support, and I'll see you on the front lines.
Author Jim Hightower. We'll hear from him a little later in tonight's show. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.